for, was it only last night? In 1809, Driard's death had been the beginning of the end. Henry's party abandoned the stockade in the Valley of the Three Forks and fled south. The move put them out of range of the Blackfeet, but did not protect them from the harshness of the Rockies themselves. The party endured savage cold, near starvation, and then robbery at the hands of the Crow. When they finally limped from the mountains in 1811, the viability of the fur trade remained an unsettled question. More than a decade later, Henry again found himself leading trappers in pursuit of the Rockies' elusive wealth. In his mind, Henry flipped through the pages of his own recent past. A week out of St. Louis, he lost a keelboat with $10,000 in trading goods. The Blackfeet killed two of his men near the Great Falls of the Missouri.
He had rushed up to Ashley's aid at the Arikara villages,
participated in the debacle with Colonel Leavenworth, and then watched the Arikara close the Missouri. In a week of overland travel up the Grand, three of his men had been killed by Mandans, normally peaceful Indians, who attacked by mistake in the night. Now Glass, his best man, lay mortally wounded after stumbling upon a bear. "What sin has plagued me with this curse?" Back in the clearing, Bridger arranged a blanket over Glass and turned to look at the bear. Four men worked at butchering the animal. The choicest cuts, the liver, heart, tongue, loin, and ribs, were set aside for immediate consumption. The rest they cut into thin strips and rubbed with salt. Bridger walked up to the great bear's paw and removed his knife from its scabbard. As Fitzgerald looked up from his butchering, Bridger began to cut the largest of the claws from the paw. He was shocked at its size, nearly 6 inches long and twice as thick as his thumb. It was razor sharp at the point and still bloody from the attack on Glass.
"Who says you get the claw, boy?"
"It ain't for me, Fitzgerald." Bridger took the claw and walked to Glass. Glass's possibles bag lay next to him. Bridger opened it and dropped in the claw. The men gorged for hours that night, their bodies craving the rich nutrients of the greasy meat. They knew it would be days before they ate fresh meat again, and they took advantage of the feast. Captain Henry posted two sentries. Despite the relative seclusion of the clearing, he worried about the fires. Most of the men sat within reach of the flames, tending skewers of willow branches laden with meat. The captain and Bridger took turns checking on Glass. Twice, his eyes were open, unfocused and glazed. They reflected the firelight, but seemed not to spark from within. Once, he managed to swallow water in a painful convulsion. They fed the fire in the long pits often enough to keep heat and smoke on the racks of drying meat. In the hour before dawn, Captain Henry checked on Glass and found him unconscious. His breathing had become labored, and he rasped, as if each breath required the sum total of his strength. Henry returned to the fire and found Black Harris there, gnawing on a rib.
"Could have been anyone, Captain. Stepping on old Ephraim like that, there's no accounting for bad luck."
Henry just shook his head. He knew about luck. For a while they sat in silence, as the first hint of another day was born in a barely perceptible glow on the eastern horizon. The captain gathered his rifle and powder horn. "I'll be back before the sun's up. When the men wake up, pick two to dig a grave." An hour later, the captain returned. The shallow beginnings of a grave had been dug, but apparently abandoned. He looked at Harris. "What's the hitch?"
"Well, Captain, for starters, he ain't dead. Didn't seem right to keep digging with him laying there."
They waited all morning for Hugh Glass to die. He never gained consciousness. His skin was pallid from the loss of blood, and his breathing remained labored. Still, his chest rose and fell, each breath stubbornly followed by another. Captain Henry paced between the stream and the clearing, and by mid-morning sent Black Harris to scout upstream. The sun stood directly overhead when Harris returned. He had seen no Indians, but a game trail on the opposite bank was covered with the tracks of men and horses. 2 miles upstream, Harris had found a deserted campsite. The captain could wait no more. He ordered 2 men to cut saplings. With Glass's bedroll, they would fashion a litter.
"Why don't we make a travois, Captain? Use the mule to pull it?"
"Too rough to pull a travois by the river."
"Then let's move off the river."
"Just build the damn litter," said the captain.
The river was the sole marker across unknown terrain. Henry had no intention of veering so much as an inch from its banks. 4. August 28th, 1823. One by one, the men reached the obstacle and stopped. The Grand River flowed directly into the steep face of a sandstone cliff, which forced it to turn. The waters swirled and pooled deeply against the wall before spreading widely toward the opposite shore. Bridger and Pig arrived last, bearing Glass between them. They eased the litter to the ground. Pig plopped heavily to his rump, panting, his shirt stained dark with sweat. Each man looked up as he arrived, quickly appreciating the 2 choices for moving forward. One was to climb along the steep face of the cliff. It was possible, but only by using hands as well as feet. This was the path taken by Black Harris when he had passed 2 hours before them. They could see his tracks and the broken branch on the sagebrush that he had grabbed to pull himself up. It was obvious that neither the litter bearers nor the mule could make the climb. The other option was to cross the river. The opposite bank was level and inviting, but the problem was getting there. The pool created by the embankment appeared at least 5 feet deep, and the current ran swift. Seam water toward the middle of the river marked the place where the stream shallowed. From there, it was an easy wade to the other side. A sure-footed man might keep his feet in the deep water, holding his rifle and powder above his head. The less agile might fall, but could certainly swim the few yards to the shallower water. Getting the mule in the river was no problem. So famous was the animal's love of water that the men called her Duck. At the end of the day, she would stand for hours in water up to her sagging belly. In fact, it was this odd predilection that kept the Mandans from stealing her along with the rest of their stock. While the other animals were grazing or sleeping along the shore, Duck was standing in shallow water on a sandbar. When the bandits tried to take her, she was firmly stuck in the mud. It ultimately took half the brigade to pull her out. So the problem wasn't the mule. The problem, of course, was Glass. It would be impossible to hold the litter above the water while crossing. Captain Henry mulled his choices, cursing Harris for not leaving a sign to cross earlier. They had passed an easy ford 1 mile downstream. He hated to divide the men, even for a few hours, but it seemed silly to march them all back. "Fitzgerald, Anderson, it's your turn on the litter. Bruneau, you and me will go back with them to the crossing we passed. Rest of you cross here and wait." Fitzgerald glared at the captain, muttering under his breath. "You got something to say, Fitzgerald?"
"I signed on to be a trapper, Captain, not a goddamn mule."
"You'll take your turn like everybody else."
"And I'll tell you what everybody else is afraid to say to your face. We're all wondering if you intend to drag this corpse all the way to the Yellowstone."
"I intend to do the same with him that I do for you or any other man in this brigade."
"What you'll be doing for all of us is digging graves. How long do you figure we can parade through this valley before we stumble on some hunting party? Glass ain't the only man in this brigade."
"You ain't the only man either," said Anderson. "Fitzgerald don't speak for me, Captain, and I bet he don't speak for many others."
Anderson walked to the litter, placing his rifle next to Glass. You gonna make me drag him?
For 3 days, they had carried Glass. The banks of the Grand alternated between sandbar and jumbled rock. Occasional stands of cottonwood gave way at the high water line to the graceful branches of willows, some reaching 10 feet in height. Cut banks forced them to climb, giant scoops where erosion sliced away the earth as neatly as a cleaver. They maneuvered around the tangled debris left piled behind the spring flood, mounded stones, tangled branches, and even entire trees, their sun-bleached trunks as smooth as glass from the beating of water and stone. When the terrain became too rugged, they crossed the river to continue upstream, wet buckskins compounding the weight of their load. The river was a highway on the plains, and Henry's men were not the only travelers on its banks. Tracks and abandoned campsites were numerous. Black Harris had twice seen small hunting parties. The distance had been too great to determine if they were Sioux or Arikara, though both tribes presented danger. The Arikara were certain enemies since the battle on the Missouri. The Sioux had been allies in that fight, but their current disposition was unknown. With only 10 able men, the small party of trappers offered little deterrent to attack. At the same time, their weapons, traps, and even the mule were attractive targets. Ambush was a constant danger, with only the scouting skills of Black Harris and Captain Henry to steer them clear. Territory to cross quickly, thought the captain. Instead, they plodded forward at the leaden pace of a funeral procession. Glass slipped in and out of consciousness, though one state differed little from the other. He could occasionally take water, but the throat wounds made it impossible to swallow solid food. Twice the litter spilled, dumping Glass on the ground. The second spill broke two of the stitches in his throat. They stopped long enough for the captain to re-suture the neck, red now with infection. No one bothered to inspect the other wounds. There was little they could do for them anyway. Nor could Glass protest. His wounded throat rendered him mute, his only sound the pathetic wheeze of his breathing. At the end of the third day, they arrived at the confluence of a small creek with the Grand. A quarter mile up the creek, Black Harris found a spring, surrounded by a thick stand of pines. It was an ideal campsite. Henry dispatched Anderson and Harris to find game. The spring itself was more seep than font, but its icy water filtered over mossy stones and collected in a clear pool. Captain Henry stooped to drink while he thought about the decision he had made. In 3 days of carrying Glass, the captain estimated they had covered only 40 miles. They should have covered twice that distance, or more. While Henry believed they might be beyond Arikara territory, Black Harris found more signs each day of the Sioux. Beyond his concerns about where they were, Henry fretted about where they needed to be. More than anything, he worried that they would arrive too late on the Yellowstone. Without a couple of weeks to lay in a supply of meat, the whole brigade would be at jeopardy. Late fall weather was as capricious as a deck of cards. They might find Indian summer, or the howling winds of an early blizzard. Aside from their physical safety, Henry felt enormous pressure for commercial success. With luck, a few weeks of fall hunting and some trading with the Indians, they might net enough fur to justify sending one or two men downriver. The captain loved to imagine the effect of a fur-laden pirogue arriving in St. Louis on some bright February day. Stories of their successful establishment on the Yellowstone would headline the Missouri Republican. The press would bring new investors. Ashley could parlay fresh capital into a new fur brigade by early spring. By late summer, Henry envisioned himself commanding a network of trappers up and down the Yellowstone. With enough men and trading goods, maybe he could even buy peace with the Blackfeet, and once again trap in the beaver-rich valleys of the Three Forks. By next winter, it would take flatboats to carry the plews they would harvest. But it all depended upon time. Being there first and in force, Henry felt the press of competition from every point on the compass.
From the north, the British Northwest Company had established forts as far south as the Mandan villages. The British also dominated the western coast, from which they now pushed inland along the Columbia and its tributaries. Rumors circulated that British trappers had penetrated as far as the Snake and the Green. From the south, several groups spread northward from Taos and Santa Fe. The Columbia Fur Company, the French Fur Company, Stone Bostwick and Company. Most visible of all was the competition from the east, from St. Louis itself. In 1819, the U.S. Army began its Yellowstone expedition with the express goal of enlarging the fur trade. Though extremely limited, the Army's presence emboldened entrepreneurs already eager to pursue the fur trade. Manuelisa's Missouri Fur Company opened trade on the Platte. John Jacob Astor revived the remnants of his American Fur Company, driven from the Columbia by the British in the War of 1812, by establishing a new headquarters in St. Louis. All competed for limited sources of capital and men. Henry glanced at Glass, lying on the litter in the shade of the pines. He had never returned to the task of properly stitching Glass's scalp. It still lay haphazardly atop his head, purple-black around the edges where dried blood now held it in place, a grotesque crown on a shattered body. The captain felt anew the polarizing mix of sympathy and anger, resentment and guilt. He could not blame Glass for the grizzly attack. The bear was simply a hazard in their path, one of many. When the troop left St. Louis, Henry knew that men would die. Glass's wounded body merely underscored the precipice that each of them walked every day. Henry considered Glass his best man, the best mix of seasoning, skills, and disposition. The others, with the possible exception of Black Harris, he viewed as subordinates. They were younger, dumber, weaker, less experienced. But Captain Henry saw Glass as a peer. If it could happen to Glass, it could happen to anyone. It could happen to him. The captain turned from the dying man. He knew that leadership required him to make tough decisions for the good of the brigade. He knew that the frontier respected, required independence and self-sufficiency above all else. There were no entitlements west of St. Louis. Yet the fierce individuals who comprised his frontier community were bound together by the tight weave of collective responsibility. Though no law was written, there was a crude rule of law, adherence to a covenant that transcended their selfish interests. It was biblical in its depth, and its importance grew with each step into wilderness. When the need arose, a man extended a helping hand to his friends, to his partners, to strangers. In doing so, each knew that his own survival might one day depend upon the reaching grasp of another. The utility of his code seemed diminished as the captain struggled to apply it to Glass. Haven't I done my best for him? Tending his wounds, portaging him, waiting respectfully so that he might at least have a civilized burial. Through Henry's decisions, they had subordinated their collective needs to the needs of one man. It was the right thing to do, but it could not be sustained. Not here. The captain had thought of abandoning Glass outright. In fact, so great was Glass's suffering that Henry had wondered briefly whether they should put a bullet in his head, bring his misery to an end. He quickly dismissed any notion of killing Glass, but he wondered if he could somehow communicate with the wounded man, make him understand that he could no longer risk the entire brigade. They could find him shelter, leave him with a fire, weapons, and provisions. If his condition improved, he could join them on the Missouri. Knowing Glass, he suspected this was what the man would ask for if he could speak for himself. Surely he wouldn't jeopardize the lives of the other men. Yet Captain Henry couldn't bring himself to leave the wounded man behind. There had been no coherent conversation with Glass since the bear attack, so ascertaining his wishes was impossible. Absent such clear guidance, he would make no assumptions.
He was the leader, and Glass was his responsibility. But so are the other men. So was Ashley's investment. So was his family back in St. Louis, a family that had waited more than a decade for the commercial success that seemed always as distant as the mountains themselves. That night, the men of the brigade gathered around the three small fire pits. They had fresh meat to smoke, a buffalo calf, and the shelter of the pines gave them added confidence in building fires. The late August evening cooled quickly after sunset, not cold, but a reminder that a change of season lurked just over the horizon. The captain stood to address the men, a formality that foreshadowed the seriousness of what he would say. "We need to make better time. I need two volunteers to stay with Glass. Stay with him here until he dies. Give him a proper burial, then catch up. The Rocky Mountain Fur Company will pay $70 for the risk of staying back." A pine knot burst from one of the fires, catapulting sparks into the clear night sky. Otherwise, the camp fell silent as the men pondered the situation and the offer. It was eerie to contemplate Glass's death, however certain. A Frenchman named Jean Bernot crossed himself. Most of the others simply stared at the fire. No one said anything for a long time. They all thought about the money. $70 was more than a third of their wage for the entire year. Viewed through the cold prism of economics, Glass would surely die soon. $70 to sit in a clearing for a few days, then a week of tough marching to catch up with the brigade. Of course, they all knew there was a real risk in staying back. 10 men were a little deterrent from an attack. 2 were none. If a war party happened upon them, $70 bought you nothing if you were dead.
"I'll stay with him, Captain."
The other men turned, surprised that the volunteer was Fitzgerald. Captain Henry was unsure how to react, so suspicious was he of Fitzgerald's motive. Fitzgerald read the hesitation.
"I ain't doing it for love, Captain. I'm doing it for money, pure and simple. Pick somebody else if you want somebody to mother him."
Captain Henry looked around the loose circle of men. "Who else will stay?" Black Harris threw a small stick on the fire.
"I will, Captain."
Glass had been a friend to Harris, and the idea of leaving him with Fitzgerald didn't sit right. None of the men liked Fitzgerald. Glass deserved better. The captain shook his head. "You can't stay, Harris."
"What do you mean, I can't stay?"
"You can't stay. I know you were his friend, so I'm sorry, but I need you to scout." Another long silence followed. Most of the men stared blankly into the fire. One by one, they arrived at the same uncomfortable conclusion. It wasn't worth it. The money wasn't worth it. Ultimately, Glass wasn't worth it. Not that they didn't respect him, like him, even. Some, like Anderson, felt an additional debt, a sense of obligation for gratuitous acts of past kindness. It would be different, thought Anderson, if the captain were asking them to defend Glass's life, but that was not the task at hand. The task at hand was waiting for Glass to die, then burying him. It wasn't worth it. Henry began to wonder if he would have to entrust the job to Fitzgerald alone when suddenly Jim Bridger rose clumsily to his feet.
"I'll stay."
Fitzgerald snorted sarcastically.
"Jesus, Captain. You can't leave me to do this with some pork-eating boy. If it's Bridger that stays, you better pay me double for 10 to 2.
The words jabbed at Bridger like punches. He felt his blood rise in embarrassment and anger.
"I promise you, Captain, I'll pull my weight."
This was not the outcome the captain had expected. A part of him felt that leaving Glass with Bridger and Fitzgerald differed little from abandonment. Bridger was barely more than a boy. In his year with the Rocky Mountain Fur Company, he had proved himself to be honest and capable. but he was no counterweight to Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald was a mercenary. But then, thought the captain, wasn't that the essence of the course he had chosen? Wasn't he simply buying proxies, purchasing a substitute for their collective responsibility, for his own responsibility? What else could he do? There was no better choice. All right, then, said the captain. Rest of us, leave at dawn. 5. August 30th, 1823. It was the evening of the second day since the departure of Captain Henry and the brigade. Fitzgerald had dispatched the boy to gather wood, leaving himself and Glass alone in the camp. Glass lay near one of the small fires. Fitzgerald ignored him. A rock formation crowned the steep slope above the clearing. Massive boulders stood in a rocky stack, as if titanic hands had piled them one on top of the other and then pressed. From a crack between two of the great stones grew a lone, twisted pine. The tree was a sibling to the lodgepole pines that the local tribes used to frame their teepees, but the seed of its origin had been lifted high above the fertile soil of the forest below. A sparrow had pried it from a pine cone decades before, carrying it to a lofty height above the clearing. The sparrow lost the seed to a crevice between the rocks. There was soil in the crevice, and a timely rain for germination. The rocks drew heat in the daytime, compensating in part for the exposure of the outcropping. There was no straight path to sunlight, so the pine grew sideways before it grew upward, worming its way from the crevice before turning toward the sky. A few gnarled branches extended from the warped trunk, each capped with a scruffy tuft of needles. The lodgepoles below grew straight as arrows, some towering 60 feet above the floor of the forest. But none grew higher than the twisted pine on top of the rock. Since the captain and the brigade left, Fitzgerald's strategy was simple. Lay in a supply of jerked meat so they were ready to move fast when Glass died. In the meantime, stay away from their camp as much as possible. Though they were off the main river, Fitzgerald had little confidence in their position on the creek. The little stream led straight to the clearing. The charred remains of campfires made it clear that others had availed themselves of the sheltered spring. In fact, Fitzgerald feared that the clearing was a well-known campsite. Even if it were not, the tracks of the brigade and the mule led clearly from the river. A hunting or war party couldn't help but find them if they came up the near bank of the Grand. Fitzgerald looked bitterly at Glass. Out of morbid curiosity, he had examined Glass's wounds on the day the rest of the troop left. The sutures in the wounded man's throat had held since the litter spilled, but the entire area was red with infection. The puncture wounds on his leg and arm seemed to be healing, but the deep slashes on his back were inflamed. Lucky for him, Glass spent most of his time unconscious.
When will a bastard die?
It was a twisted path that brought John Fitzgerald to the frontier, a path that began with his flight from New Orleans in 1815, the day after he stabbed a prostitute to death in a drunken rage. Fitzgerald grew up in New Orleans, the son of a Scottish sailor and a Cajun merchant's daughter. His father put in port once a year during the 10 years of marriage before his ship went down in the Caribbean. On each call to New Orleans, he left his fertile wife with the seed of a new addition to the family. 3 months after learning of her husband's death, Fitzgerald's mother married the elderly owner of a sundry shop, an action she viewed as essential to support her family. Her pragmatic decision served most of her children well. 8 survived to adulthood. The 2 eldest sons took over the sundry shop when the old man died. Most of the other boys found honest work, and the girls married respectfully. John got lost somewhere in the middle. From an early age, Fitzgerald demonstrated both a reflex toward and a skill for engaging in violence.
He was quick to resolve disputes with a punch or a kick, and was thrown out of school at the age of 10 for stabbing a classmate in the leg with a pencil. Fitzgerald had no interest in the hard labor of following his father to sea, but he mixed eagerly in the seedy chaos of a port town. His fighting skills were tested and honed on the docks where he spent his teenage days. At 17, a boatman slashed his face in a barroom brawl. The incident left him with a fishhook scar and a new respect for cutlery. He became fascinated with knives, acquiring a collection of daggers and scalpers in a wide range of sizes and shapes. At the age of 20, Fitzgerald fell in love with a young whore at a dockside saloon, a French girl named Dominique Perrault. Despite the financial underpinnings of their relationship, the full implications of Dominique's métier apparently did not register with Fitzgerald. When he walked in on Dominique plying her trade with the fat captain of a keelboat, the young man fell into a rage. He stabbed them both before fleeing into the streets. He stole $84 from his brother's store and hired passage on a boat headed north, up the Mississippi. For 5 years, he made his living in and around the taverns of Memphis. He tended bar in exchange for room, board, and a small salary at an establishment known, with pretensions that exceeded its grasp, as the Golden Lion. His official capacity as barkeep gave him something he had not possessed in New Orleans, a license to engage in violence. He removed disorderly patrons with a relish that startled even the rough-cut clientele of the saloon. Twice, he nearly beat men to death. Fitzgerald possessed some of the mathematical skills that made his brothers successful storekeepers, and he applied his native intelligence toward gambling. For a while, he was content to squander his paltry stipend from the bar. Over time, he was drawn to higher stakes. These new games required more money to play, and Fitzgerald found no shortage of lenders. Not long after borrowing $200 from the owner of a rival tavern, Fitzgerald hit it big. He won $1,000 on a single hand of queens over tens and spent the next week in a celebratory debauch. The payoff infused him with a false confidence in his gambling skills and a ravenous hunger for more. He quit his work at the Golden Lion and sought to make his living at cards. His luck veered sharply south, and a month later he owed $2,000 to a loan shark named Jeffrey Robinson. He dodged Robinson for several weeks before two henchmen caught him and broke his arm. They gave him a week to pay the balance due. In desperation, Fitzgerald found a second lender, a German named Hans Bangermann, to pay off the first. With the $2,000 in his hands, however, Fitzgerald had an epiphany. He would flee Memphis and start someplace new. The next morning, he took passage on another boat north. He landed in St. Louis late in the month of February, 1822. After a month in the new city, Fitzgerald learned that two men had been asking at pubs about the whereabouts of a gambler with a scar on his face. In the small world of Memphis moneylenders, it had not taken long for Jeffrey Robinson and Hans Bangermann to discover the full measure of Fitzgerald's treachery. For $100 each, they hired a pair of henchmen to find Fitzgerald, kill him, and recover as much of their loans as possible. They harbored little hope of getting their money back, but they did want Fitzgerald dead. They had reputations to uphold, and word was spread of their plan through the network of Memphis taverns. Fitzgerald was trapped. St. Louis was the northernmost outpost of civilization on the Mississippi. He was afraid to go south, where trouble awaited him in New Orleans and Memphis. That day, Fitzgerald overheard a group of pub patrons talking excitedly about a newspaper ad in the Missouri Republican. He picked up the paper and read for himself. To enterprising young men, the subscriber wishes to engage 100 young men to ascend the Missouri River to its source, there to be employed for 1, 2, or 3 years. For particulars, inquire of Captain Henry, near the lead mines in the country of Washington, who will ascend with and command the party. Fitzgerald made a rash decision. With the paltry remnants of the money he had stolen from Hans Bangemann, he bought a weathered leather tunic, moccasins, and a rifle. The next day he presented himself to Captain Henry and requested a spot with the fur brigade. Henry was suspicious of Fitzgerald from the beginning, but pickings were slim. The captain needed 100 men, and Fitzgerald looked fit. If he'd been in a few knife fights, so much the better. A month later, Fitzgerald was on a keelboat, headed north, up the Missouri River. Although he fully intended to desert the Rocky Mountain Fur Company when the opportunity presented itself, Fitzgerald took to life on the frontier. He found that his skill with knives extended to other weapons. Fitzgerald had none of the tracking skills of the real woodsman in the brigade, but he was an excellent shot. With a sniper's patience, he had killed 2 Arikara during the recent siege on the Missouri. Many of Henry's men had been terrified in their fights with various Indians. Fitzgerald found them exhilarating, even titillating. Fitzgerald glanced at Glass, his eyes falling on the Anstalt lying next to the wounded man. He looked around to make sure that Bridger wasn't returning, then picked up the rifle. He pulled it to his shoulder and sighted down the barrel. He loved how the gun fit snug against his body, how the wide pronghorn sights found targets quickly, how the lightness of the weapon let him hold a steady bead. He swung from target to target, up and down, until the sights came to rest on Glass. Once again, Fitzgerald thought about how the Anstalt soon would be his. They hadn't talked about it with the captain, but who deserved the rifle more than the man who stayed behind? Certainly, his claim was better than Bridger's. All the trappers admired Glass's gun. $70 was paltry pay for the risk they were taking. Fitzgerald was there for the Anstalt. Such a weapon should not be wasted on a boy. Besides, Bridger was happy enough to get William Anderson's rifle. Throw him some other crumb. Glass's knife, perhaps. Fitzgerald mulled the plan he had formed since he volunteered to stay with Glass, a plan that seemed more compelling with each passing hour. What difference does a day make to Glass? On the other hand, Fitzgerald knew exactly the difference a day meant to his own prospects for survival. Fitzgerald set the Anstalt down. A bloody shirt lay next to Glass's head. Push it against his face for a few minutes. We could be on our way in the morning. He looked again at the rifle, its dark brown striking against the orange hue of fallen pine needles. He reached for the shirt.
Did he wake up?
Bridger stood behind him, his arms full of firewood. Fitzgerald startled, fumbling for an instant.
Christ, boy, sneak up on me like that again, and I swear to God I'll cut you down.
Bridger dropped the wood and walked over to Glass.
I was thinking maybe we ought to try giving him some broth.
Why, that's mighty kind of you, Bridger. Pour a little broth down that throat, maybe he'll last a week instead of dying tomorrow. Will that make you sleep better? What did you think, that if you give him a little soup, he's going to get up and walk away from here?
Bridger was quiet for a minute, then said, You act like you want him to die.
Of course I want him to die. Look at him. He wants to die.
Fitzgerald paused for effect.
You ever go to school, Bridger?
Fitzgerald knew the answer to his question. The boy shook his head.
Well, let me give you a little lesson in arithmetic. Captain Henry and the rest are probably making around 30 miles a day now that they're not dragging Glass. Let's figure we'll be faster. Say we make 40. Do you know what's 40 minus 30, Bridger?
The boy stared blankly.
I'll tell you what it is. It's 10.
Fitzgerald held up the fingers of both hands in a mocking gesture.
This many, boy. Whatever their head start is, we only make up 10 miles a day once we take after them. They're already 100 miles ahead of us. That's 10 days on our own, Bridger. And that assumes he dies today and we find him straight away. 10 days for a Sioux hunting party to stumble on us. Don't you get it? Every day we sit here is another 3 days we're on our own. You'll look worse than glass when the Sioux are finished with you, boy. You ever see a man who got scalped?
Bridger said nothing, though he had seen a man scalped. He was there near the Great Falls when Captain Henry brought the two dead trappers back to camp, butchered by Blackfeet. Bridger vividly remembered the bodies. The captain had tied them belly down to a single pack mule. When he cut them loose, they fell stiffly to the ground. The trappers had gathered round them, mesmerized, as they contemplated the mutilated corpses of the men they had seen that morning at the campfire. And it wasn't just their scalps that were missing. Their noses and ears had been hacked away, and their eyes gouged out. Bridger remembered how, without noses, the heads looked more like skulls than faces. The men were naked, and the privates were gone, too. There was a stark tan line at their necks and wrists. Above the line, their skin was as tough and brown as saddle leather, but the rest of their bodies was as white as lace. It looked funny, almost. It was the type of thing that one of the men would have joked about, if it hadn't been so horrible. Of course, nobody laughed. Bridger always thought about it when he washed himself, how underneath they all had this lacy white skin, weak as a baby. Bridger struggled, desperately wanting to challenge Fitzgerald, but wholly incapable of articulating a rebuttal. Not for lack of words this time, but rather for lack of reasons. It was easy to condemn Fitzgerald's motivation. He said himself it was money, but what he wondered was his own motivation. It wasn't money. The numbers all jumbled together, and his regular salary was already more wealth than he had ever seen. Bridger liked to believe that his motive was loyalty. Fidelity to a fellow member of the brigade. He certainly respected Glass. Glass had been kind, watching out for him in small ways, schooling him, defending him against embarrassments. Bridger acknowledged a debt to Glass. But how far did it extend? The boy remembered the surprise and admiration in the eyes of the men when he had volunteered to stay with Glass. What a contrast to the anger and contempt of that terrible night on sentry duty. He remembered how the captain had patted him on the shoulder when the brigade departed, and how the simple gesture had filled him with a sense of affiliation, as if for the first time he deserved his place among the men. Wasn't that why he was there in the clearing, to salve his wounded pride? Not to take care of another man, but to take care of himself. Wasn't he just like Fitzgerald, profiting from another man's misfortune? Say what you would about Fitzgerald. At least he was honest about why he stayed.
6. August 31st, 1823. Alone in the camp on the morning of the third day, Bridger spent several hours repairing his moccasins, both of which had developed holes in the course of their travels. As a consequence, his feet were scraped and bruised, and the boy appreciated the opportunity for the repair work. He cut leather from a rawhide left when the brigade departed, used an awl to punch holes around the edge, and replaced the soles with the new hide on bottom. The stitching was irregular but tight. As he examined his handiwork, his eyes fell on Glass. Flies buzzed around his wounds, and Bridger noticed that Glass's lips were cracked and parched. The boy questioned again whether he stood on any higher moral plane than Fitzgerald. Bridger filled his large tin cup with cold water from the spring and put it to Glass's mouth. The wetness triggered an unconscious reaction, and Glass began to drink. Bridger was disappointed. When Glass finished, it was good to feel useful. The boy stared at Glass. Fitzgerald was right, of course. There was no question that Glass would die.
But shouldn't I do my best for him? At least provide comfort in his final hours? Bridger's mother could tease a healing property from anything that grew. He wished many times that he had paid more attention when she had returned from the woods, her basket filled with flowers, leaves, and bark. He did know a few basics, and on the edge of the clearing, he found what he was looking for, a pine tree with its sticky gum oozing like molasses. He used his rusty skinning knife to scrape off the gum, working until his blade was smeared with a good quantity. He walked back to Glass and knelt next to him. The boy focused first on the leg and arm wounds, the deep punctures from the grizzly's fangs. While the surrounding areas remained black and blue, the skin itself appeared to be repairing. Bridger used his finger to apply the gum, filling the wounds and smearing the surrounding skin. Next, he rolled Glass to his side in order to examine his back. The crude sutures had snapped when the litter spilled, and there were signs of more recent bleeding. Still, it wasn't blood that gave Glass's back its crimson sheen. It was infection. The 5 parallel cuts extended almost the entire length of his back. There was yellow pus in the center of the cuts, and the edges practically glowed fiery red. The odor reminded Bridger of sour milk. Unsure what to do, he simply smeared the entire area with pine gum, returning twice to the trees to gather more. Bridger turned last to the neck wounds. The captain's sutures remained in place, though to the boy they seemed merely to conceal the carnage beneath the skin. The wheezing rumble continued from Glass's unconscious breathing, like the loose rattle of broken parts in a machine. Bridger walked again into the pines, this time looking for a tree with loose bark. He found one and used his knife to pry loose the outer skin. The tender inner bark he gathered in his hat. Bridger filled his cup again with water at the spring and set it in the coals of the fire. When it boiled, he added the pine bark, mashing the mixture with the pommel of his knife. He worked until the consistency was thick and smooth as mud. He waited for the poultice to cool slightly, then applied it to Glass's throat, packing the mixture against the slashes and spreading it outward toward his shoulder. Next, Bridger walked to his small pack, pulling out the remnants of his spare shirt. He used the cloth to cover the poultice, lifting Glass's head to tie a knot firmly behind the man's neck. Bridger let the wounded man's head return gently to the ground, surprised to find himself staring into Glass's open eyes. They burned with an intensity and lucidity that juxtaposed oddly against his broken body. Bridger stared back, searching to discern the message that Glass clearly intended to convey.
What is he saying?
Glass stared at the boy for a minute before allowing his eyes to fall closed. In his fleeting moments of consciousness, Glass felt a heightened sensitivity, as if suddenly made aware of the secret workings of his body. The boy's efforts provided topical relief. The slight stinging of the pine gum had a medicinal quality, and the heat from the poultice created a steeping comfort at his throat. At the same time, Glass sensed that his body was marshaling itself for another decisive battle, not at the surface, but deep within. By the time Fitzgerald returned to camp, the shadows of late afternoon had stretched into the fading glow of early evening. He carried a doe over his shoulder. He had field-dressed the animal, slitting her neck and removing the entrails. He let the deer fall next to one of the fires. She landed in an unnatural pile, so different from her grace in life. Fitzgerald stared at the fresh dressings on Glass's wounds. His face tensed.
You're wasting your time with him.
He paused.
I wouldn't give a tinker's damn, except you're wasting my time, too.
Bridger ignored the comment, though he felt the blood rise in his face.
How old are you, boy?
20?
You lying piece of horse shit. You can't even talk without squeaking. I bet you never seen a tit that wasn't your ma's.
The boy looked away, hating Fitzgerald for his bloodhound ability to sense weakness.
Fitzgerald absorbed Bridger's discomfort like the nourishment of raw meat. He laughed.
What? You never been with a woman? I'm right, aren't I, boy? What's the matter, Bridger? You didn't have $2 for a whore before we left St. Louis?
Fitzgerald eased his large frame to the ground, sitting down to better enjoy himself.
Maybe you don't like girls. You a bugger, boy? Maybe I need to sleep on my back, keep you from rutting at me in the night.
Still, Bridger said nothing.
Or maybe you got no pecker at all.
Without thinking, Bridger jumped to his feet, grabbed his rifle, cocked it, and pointed the long barrel at Fitzgerald's head.
You son of a bitch, Fitzgerald. Say another word and I'll blow your damn head off.
Fitzgerald sat stunned, staring at the dark muzzle of the rifle barrel. For a long moment, he sat like that, just staring at the muzzle. Then his dark eyes moved slowly up to Bridger's, a smile creeping to join the scar on his face.
Well, good for you, Bridger. Maybe you don't squat when you piss after all.
He snorted at his joke, pulled out his knife, and set to butchering the deer. In the quiet of the camp, Bridger became aware of the heavy sound of his own breathing and could feel the rapid beat of his heart. He lowered the gun and set the butt on the ground, then lowered himself. He felt suddenly tired and pulled his blanket around his shoulders. After several minutes, Fitzgerald said,
"Hey, boy."
Bridger looked over, but said nothing in acknowledgement. Fitzgerald casually wiped the back of a bloody hand against his nose.
That new gun of yours won't fire without a flint.
Bridger looked down at his rifle. The flint was missing from the lock. The blood rose again in his face, though this time he hated himself as much as Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald laughed quietly and continued his skillful work with the long knife. In truth, Jim Bridger was 19 that year, with a slight build that made him look younger still. The year of his birth, 1804, coincided with the launch of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and it was the excitement generated by their return that led Jim's father to venture west from Virginia in 1812. The Bridger family settled on a small farm at Six Mile Prairie near St. Louis. For a boy of 8, the voyage west was a grand adventure of bumpy roads, hunting for supper, and sleeping beneath a canopy of open sky. In the new farm, Jim found a 40-acre playground of meadows, woods, and creeks. The first week on the new property, Jim discovered a small spring. He remembered vividly his excitement as he led his father to the hidden seep, and his pride when they built the spring house. Among many trades, Jim's father dabbled in surveying. Jim often tagged along, further fixing a taste for exploration. Bridger's childhood ended abruptly at the age of 13, when his mother, father, and older brother all died of fever in the space of a single month. The boy found himself suddenly responsible for both himself and a younger sister. An elderly aunt came to tend for his sister, but the financial burden for the family fell upon Jim. He took a job with the owner of a ferry. The Mississippi of Bridger's boyhood teemed with traffic. From the south, manufactured supplies moved upriver to the booming St. Louis, while downstream flowed the raw resources of the frontier. Bridger heard stories about the great city of New Orleans and the foreign ports beyond. He met the wild boatmen who pushed their craft upstream through sheer strength of body and will. He talked to teamsters who portaged products from Lexington and Terre Haute. He saw the future of the river in the form of belching steamboats churning against the current. Yet it wasn't the Mississippi River that captured Jim Bridger's imagination. It was the Missouri. A mere 6 miles from his ferry, the two great rivers joined as one. The wild waters of the frontier pouring into the bromide current of the everyday. It was the confluence of old and new, known and unknown, civilization and wilderness. Bridger lived for the rare moments when the fur traders and voyageurs tied their sleek mackinaws at the ferry landing, sometimes even camping for the night. He marveled at their tales of savage Indians, teeming game, forever plains, and soaring mountains. The frontier for Bridger became an aching presence that he could feel but could not define, a magnetic force pulling him inexorably towards something that he had heard about but never seen. A preacher on a sway-backed mule rode Bridger's ferry one day. He asked Bridger if he knew God's mission for him in life. Without pause, Bridger answered, "Go to the Rockies." The preacher was elated, urging the boy to consider missionary work with the savages. Bridger had no interest in bringing Jesus to the Indians, but the conversation stuck with him. The boy came to believe that going west was more than just a fancy for someplace new. He came to see it as a part of his soul, a missing piece that could only be made whole on some far-off mountain or plain. Against this backdrop of an imagined future, Bridger pulled the sluggish ferry, to and fro, back and forth, motion without progression, never venturing so much as a mile beyond the fixed points of the two landings. It was the polar opposite of the life he imagined for himself, a life of wandering and exploration through country unknown, a life in which he never once retraced his steps. After a year on the ferry, Bridger made a desperate and ill-thought effort to make some progress westward, apprenticing himself to a blacksmith in St. Louis. The blacksmith treated him well and even provided a modest stipend to send to his sister and aunt. But the terms of apprenticeship were clear: 5 years of servitude. If the new job did not put him in the wilderness, at least St. Louis talked of little else. For half a decade, Bridger soaked in frontier lore. When the plainsmen came to shoe their horses or repair their traps, Bridger overcame his reserve to ask about their travels. Where had they been? What had they seen? The boy heard tales of a naked John Coulter outracing 100 Blackfeet intent on taking his scalp. Like everyone in St. Louis, he came to know details of successful traders like Manuelisa and the Shoto brothers. Most exciting to Bridger were occasional glimpses of his heroes in the flesh. Once a month, Captain Andrew Henry visited the blacksmith to shoe his horse. Bridger made sure to volunteer for the work, if only for the chance that he might exchange a few words with the captain. His brief encounters with Henry were like a reaffirmation of faith, a tangible manifestation of something that otherwise might exist only as fable and tale. The term of Bridger's apprenticeship ran to his 18th birthday, and on March 17th, 1822, to coincide with the Ides of March, a local actors' brigade played a rendition of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Bridger paid 2 bits for a seat. The long play made little sense. The men looked silly in full-length gowns. And for a long time, Bridger was unsure whether the actors were speaking English. He enjoyed the spectacle, though, and after a while began to develop a feel for the rhythm of the stilted language. A handsome actor with a bellowing voice spoke a line that would stick with Bridger for the rest of his life. "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune." 3 days later, the blacksmith told Bridger about a notice in the Missouri Republican. "To enterprising young men." Bridger knew his tide had come in. The next morning, Bridger awoke to find Fitzgerald bent over glass, his hand pressed against the forehead of the wounded man.
"What are you doing, Fitzgerald?"
"How long's he had this fever?"
Bridger moved quickly to glass and felt his skin. It was steamy with heat and perspiration.
"I checked him last night and he seemed all right."
"Well, he's not all right now. It's the death sweats. The son of a bitch is finally going under."
Bridger stood there, unsure whether to feel upset or relieved. Glass began to shiver and shake. There seemed little chance that Fitzgerald was wrong.
Listen, boy, we got to be ready to move. I'm gonna scout up the Grand. You take the berries and get that meat pounded into pemmican.